On this week's 51%, meet a female duo in a male-dominated industry, furniture making. Hear about Girls Write the World.
It's just really exciting to give young female-identified writers a platform to speak.
And an opera director shares with us her craft. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning, I'd a hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd a hammer out of danger, I'd a hammer out of warning, I'd a hammer out of love between my brothers and...
Audie Culver and Ivy Ciosi own and operate Ciosi Design, a premier wooden furniture company based in Bloomington, Indiana. Like starting any business, the early days were rough. And even though they have backgrounds in art, they never received any formal training, and still they built a nationwide client base. They owe their success not only to their dedication to the craft, but also to their special bond. Producer Rick Brewer brings us the story.
When Ciosi Design started in 2012, they only had the essentials of woodworking. Now they have things like a planer.
And then this is our joiner.
An air compressor. A shop dog. Her name's Arrow.
And then our wide belt sander, that big white machine right there.
That's Audie Culver, co-owner of Ciosi Design. Audie also told me that when she's deep in thought on a project, she likes to listen to hip-hop and R&B because the cadence helps her do the physical work. And her favorite songs are...
Anything by Rihanna. I'm just kidding. Well, I'm not really kidding.
It's a dream. It's every old man's dream, for sure. I mean, we have almost everything that you could ever want.
That's Ivy Ciosi, the lead designer and Audie's business partner. Not too long ago, before they had their dream wood shop, they were just two artists trying to find their way. Right before they started Ciosi Design, Audie just finished graduate school at Indiana University, and Ivy, as she puts it, has an adverse reaction to authority. Their art backgrounds are in things like photography and printmaking. So their journey to starting a furniture company was unorthodox. But two things were certain. They'd started to get good at woodworking, and they were in love.
As soon as I saw Ivy do a backflip 180 on the trampoline, I was like, who is this girl?
It was a back with a half twist.
That's
I was working on it.
It's the same thing.
It was forbidden love at first sight. Audie was always on my mind after that. And I was looking for somebody like her when the time came, and then she came back into town.
We keep up with each other. We're both athletic but small, and we just ran around wild and had so much fun.
While Audie was a grad student, she took an 8-week course in woodworking and was surprised how much she liked it. Ivy started joining her in the shop to help with larger projects, like the wooden frames for Audie's MFA thesis show, which featured portraits of Ivy. But the experience of making these frames didn't go so well. Looking back, it was that bad experience in the wood shop that brought them closer to woodworking.
Gender is such an issue in woodworking that when you walk into a shop, as a woman, you're often just, you're treated differently. And I made myself a dining table, and I just really enjoyed the process. The guy who taught me how to make the dining table was incredible, really patient. And then there was a new guy that replaced him, and he just was really hard to work with, really difficult to work with, and patronizing.
So instead of being in there with the guy that we didn't like,
Ivy and I decided to buy some equipment and find some cheap rent somewhere.
And we started thinking about how we would want to live. So you think about what you'd want to do when you were retired. And after you've theoretically worked a long, hard life, and that's woodworking.
So they saved some money and eventually found an old RCA box factory that was renting space for $300 a month. The initial business model was to make small furniture at IKEA-like quality, but that didn't make enough money to be sustainable. And so they turned their focus to making larger, more high-quality items like bed frames, 12-foot tables, and bars. And what really helped them grow was Audie's photography. COC Design now has over 23,000 followers on Instagram, and they also used to run a popular Etsy store, which helped them get featured in magazines like Remodelista and Metropolis.
And yeah, our first really big break that led to an article in Remodelista was from just a random shopper on Etsy.
I think one of the smartest decisions we ever made was delivering that kitchen island in person, because we got to know this woman. She's the one who pitched the article to Remodelista and got it written. And she chose to, like, really try to get us some press because we went out there and we hung out and we liked each other. And now we're all really great friends. And I think we realized early on that building relationships is really the way to grow your business. Word of mouth is the best kind of business you can get.
Running a business with your partner is complicated. That's what Audie and Ivy say most people think. But they see it as an advantage and wouldn't have it any other way.
Audie is my equal, and I need her. And I know that, and thank goodness, you know? Thank goodness, because I couldn't do any of this by myself, and she's so good at the things that I'm wretched at, so it really works.
It's all based on mutual respect. Truly, we're good at very different things, and we contribute different things to the business, and we respect each other's opinions to the max, and we respect what each other are good at, and then we also respect what we're not great at, too.
We put glue here, and we clamp on, and that's how you get, like, a tabletop like that over there.
Touring COC Design's woodshop makes their startup story that much more impressive. It's not the size of the shop or its fancy equipment. It's that they were able to do all of this without any formal training and did it with a humble, hardworking attitude. COC Design is a business that was built from the ground up, founded on not only a love for woodworking, but love for each other. Reporting from Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Rick Brewer.
Girls Write the World is a literary journal featuring the works of female-identified writers and artists ages 14 through 21. The editors believe that girls' voices can and do transform the world for the better and want to help expand creative platforms for girls of all races, religions, and sexual orientations. 51%'s Josh Landes reports on the recently launched third issue, published by high schoolers in Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Emily Polfer-Torino is an English teacher at Miss Hall School. Her students call her Miss PT. She's the boarding school's faculty advisor for Girls Write the World, which she helped launch 3 years ago. By way of disclosure, the school has been a WAMC underwriter.
We had been producing the school, the internal printed literary and art magazine, and we had a vision to broaden our scope and to really advocate for artists and writers outside of Miss Hall's school and to sort of expand our sense of global connectivity. We're a really global community at Miss Hall's, and we really wanted to build on that.
The journal's current editorial staff is composed entirely of juniors who have been working for months on the release of the third issue.
Together, we read submissions from all over the world, including not only literature, but also art and photographies and all that amazing stuff.
Maggie Zhang, a junior from Guangzhou, China, is one of four editors. Submissions must come in English from writers and artists between the ages of 14 and 21.
We are basically looking for different kind of voices shared by girls or female-identified authors or artists from all over the world, which demonstrate their point of view of different things, and including things they are really interested in, including things that they want the whole world to know. And we really appreciate that each time we learn new things from them.
It doesn't necessarily have to be like, oh, girls are the greatest or whatever. It doesn't have to be a feminist piece of art to be empowering. It can sometimes just be it being a girl who probably has been told throughout her life that she's not as worthy as a boy, and still writing and making art and trying to get her voice heard. And it doesn't necessarily have to be political. It can be about anything.
Matilda Trun of Hanoi, Vietnam, is another member of the editorial staff.
It being from a girl's perspective as self can be pretty empowering for girls because we have kind of a history of not being heard and being told that we can't really make art.
I think I really appreciated just the people submitting, because like it's really interesting, like just seeing people my age submitting such beautiful work.
Editor Evelyn Stewart from New Jersey pointed to a poem called Skin Deep that spoke to her from the crop of submissions that poured in for the new issue.
It was kind of like valuing the like darker skin colors and really just like showing how beautiful they are as well. So I really appreciated it. Appreciated that, because I feel like sometimes that's not seen, that darker skin types can be beautiful and should be appreciated as much as others.
Editor Rhea Rice from Kentucky says the team has a unique method for determining what makes it into the final draft.
We do a thing where we do fist to five, so like we'll hold out how many fingers, like on a scale of five, we want it to be published the most, zero, not. and we add them up, divide by four, see if we should publish it.
She says she treasures the bios that come in with submissions to the journal, which allow her a window into the lives of her peers around the world.
It's just really exciting to give young female identified writers a platform to speak.
For 51%, I'm Josh Landes.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg returns with her 51% segment, Force of Nature. This time, she interviews opera and theater director Francesca Zambello. Zambello serves as director of the Glimmerglass Festival in Cooperstown, New York, and the Washington National Opera in Washington, D.C. She is responsible for producing 12 productions annually. Zambello, an American who grew up in Europe, is one of a handful of women opera directors.
Well, basically, I was very fortunate that my father was Italian and my mother was American. And I was born in New York City, but my father wanted to go back to Europe. So when I was about 10, we moved back to Europe and we lived in France, Germany, Austria, and England. And I got to grow up in all those countries and not see opera, but just live in a very vibrant, different kind of culture. And my mother was an actress, and so I was around the theater a lot, and I caught the theater bug early, but I never wanted to perform. I was always drawn to, I didn't know it was directing, but I loved being the person who was the storyteller and the person in charge making up the stories and putting everybody together. And somehow that sort of connected to the rest of my life and to my career. By the time I got to university back in the States, I moved to New York City and started working in what was then the off-off Broadway world of really interesting directors and very sort of different kind of theater. But I missed Europe, and I was fortunate to go back to Europe and work in an opera house in Germany, in Frankfurt, basically as what I call a glorified coffee getter. But you know, the theater is a profession where if you're around it, is how you learn. And I learned by watching great directors, and then eventually I began to get jobs working for them as their assistants, and traveled all over Europe, many different opera houses. And I was fortunate to do that because I found in the States I wasn't able to get some of those same jobs. It was a lot easier in Europe. This is all during the 80s and then into the 90s when I really started directing. So I was very happy to have those opportunities. And then eventually I started coming back to the States and getting hired in several wonderful opera houses across America, San Francisco, Houston, Chicago, and really began to make a career as an independent stage director. And then at a certain point I had felt like I had directed everywhere around the world in practically every continent, and I wanted to give back more. And so the opportunity arose to become the head of something called the Glimmerglass Festival in Cooperstown, New York, which was a summer opera festival at the time. And I took it over. This is my ninth season, and transformed it into much more of a festival atmosphere with a lot of different programming and different discussions and ideas surrounding the program. And then shortly thereafter, I became the artistic director of the Washington National Opera at the Kennedy Center, which goes hand in hand in the sense that it's sort of during the school year and Glimmerglass is in the summer. So I feel fortunate to have followed a career path that I wanted. I didn't necessarily always know what it was, but the right doors opened and I leapt into them, I think, as fearless as I could possibly be.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, one opera, you know, directing one opera, it seems, you know, one theater, it seems like something that would be all-consuming. Why direct two theater companies? Here you have one in the summer and one, you know, during the year, but I still think it's such an enormous undertaking. Is there something about each one that brings something very different to your career trajectory that you want to explore?
Absolutely. The Glimmerglass Festival is very committed to development and education. We're a professional company with many guest artists, but we also have an extremely large young artist program. And that means we take every summer about 50 young performers from all the best music and theater schools. 1,000 people audition and we choose about 50. And so they're, in a way, they're doing small parts and chorus and training with us. So that training aspect, it was really very important to me. And then on the flip side, we take another 50 young people in our intern program, which is all the people who help work in administration, development, production. And these are really career stepping stones. I liken it often to, you know, someone clerking for a judge in the legal profession or a resident in a hospital. This is a hands-on training situation. And that, to me, is one of the key things about the ethos of our company, in parallel with the fact that at Glimmerglass we produce a lot of works that have a real social conscience to them. We're involved in a lot of rural programs for younger kids. We bring opera to Attica Prison. We surround our repertory, which is three operas, with a musical and a youth opera, but with speakers as noted as Ruth Bader Ginsburg every year, or Jeffrey Toobin, or important writers like this year, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Margaret Atwood. And then on the flip side, in some ways, is Washington National Opera, which has its own training program, but is much more geared to, in what our profession we call, grand opera. The big operas, the big lavish productions. We're at the Kennedy Center, the nation's center for the arts. Really, our mission there is about putting on spectacular productions with the finest singers, international and national, so that we're really a showplace for opera in the United States. And we also there have a huge commitment to American composers. So we have a big composers program where we are developing new operas, which is so important. You can't just do La Boheme forever. So the two companies have an overlap in some ways, but they're also very different situated in terms of artistic overviews.
You know, I'm sure you have something exciting coming up this year in one or both of them. Can you share a little about something maybe perhaps new or a production that you've been working on that's coming to fruition this year?
Right. Well, as we're heading into the summer now at the Glimmerglass Festival this year, we are presenting a world premiere of a new opera called Blue by Janine Tesori and Tazwell Thompson. And Janine is
very known as a Tony Award-winning composer for her musical Fun Home. Tazewell's a superb playwright and director. And this was really, I try in our programming to look at certain key issues. And this new opera is very much about race in America today, police violence, you know, both sides of the coin. And so this work has been developed through our workshop process there. It's a very moving story of a African-American family who lose their son in a rally, actually, where he is shot by a white police officer, and the father is also a police officer. So it really tells all sides of the story of the work that our incredible policemen and women do in the United States right now, but also race and how it manifests itself in a very personal way in this piece. That piece will travel to a number of other companies afterwards, including the Kennedy Center, and then on to Chicago. So I'm thrilled we're premiering that this summer at Glimmerglass. We have a venue that is 900 seats, so it's incredibly intimate. We also do standard opera. This year we're doing La Traviata, the musical Showboat, and another great American opera called The Ghosts of Versailles, plus a youth opera called Noah's Flood, and a version of the opera The Queen of Spades, plus, as I said, speakers this year, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So it's a pretty wide program, and I'm really excited how the program all works together for up there. So, of course, we'd love to welcome anybody and everybody there. It's a beautiful part of the United States, central New York, incredible nature. We're located on an 11-mile lake, and, of course, the famous Baseball Hall of Fame is also there. So it's a rare place where culture and sports and nature can all live together in harmony.
Sounds like a very exciting season. Listen, I know, Francesca, that you're one of, you know, a few women that have risen to such, you know, the ranks in this particular field. And I would love to hear what advice you might give to other women who are also interested in directing opera or a theater company. What would you tell someone who is, you know, has the vision to follow in your footsteps?
Thank you. I think that having vision is important, but I also know that being practical is important. And that's why I often find that a lot of times young people, they don't realize you really have to get into the nitty-gritty. And a lot of times I say to people, I know you want to, you think you could do this now, but, you know, you really understand, you need to understand the workings of how it all goes together. So I encourage people to take internships, to be in a theater. Don't just say, okay, I'm only going to do it when I can really do it. I say, you know, no matter what, take whatever job to be around live performing arts and music, because it's only through being in, you know, in the trenches do you learn. Of course, you can study it, and there's a lot to learn in craft, but I'm a firm believer that the theater and opera is so much a historic profession, you know, back to the Greeks, where you really learn by doing it and by being around those who have done it before you who can pass it on. Also, I always tell people, okay, go be the person who prints 10,000 copies of the script in that theater, but then get together a group of performers and create your own theater. Exercise your muscles of, for me, it was for directing. I was lucky, actually, early on, I did get a chance in a small theater in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, called The Skylight, where I really got to direct. And no matter what, it's in a sense, it's like it's using those muscles. So I always tell people, take any job, no matter how lowly, and then the rest of you, dedicate it to creating your own theater or music or whatever it takes.
Thanks again for being with us today. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. Pregnancy-related deaths are rising in the United States, and the main risk factor is being Black, according to new reports that highlight racial disparities in care during and after childbirth. Black women, along with Native Americans and Alaska Natives, are 3 times more likely to die before, during, or after having a baby, and more than half of these deaths are preventable. This is the conclusion of a May 7th report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Although these deaths are rare, about 700 a year, they have been rising for decades. Separately, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists released new guidelines saying being Black is the greatest risk factor for these deaths. The guidelines say women should have a comprehensive heart risk evaluation 12 weeks after delivery, but up to 40% of women do not return for that visit, and payment issues may be one reason. Bleeding and infections used to cause most pregnancy-related deaths, but heart-related problems do now. Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand is promising that if elected president, she'll only appoint Supreme Court justices who strongly support the Roe v. Wade decision, imposing a key litmus test consistent with most Democrats' values, but which White House contenders usually do not express. The New York senator wrote in a Medium post on May 7th that Republican-led legislatures nationwide have attempted to impose major abortion restrictions. She said she'd only nominate judges who will commit to upholding Roe v. Wade as settled law. The 1973 case established a woman's constitutional right to abortion. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1556.